This is Winnishik Independent. We're back after a couple of month hiatus, and we'll be releasing episodes on a more regular basis from here on in, roughly monthly. For this episode, I reached out to Tom Hansen, chair of the Winnishik County Republicans, and Carl Hockenstead, chair of the County Dems, to get their take on the Iowa legislative year so far. It's been a busy session for the Republican-dominated Iowa House and Senate, and now a week after the first funnel deadline, it's time to take stock of the bills that have passed or are still in play. There's really significant stuff going on, from school vouchers or educational savings accounts, depending on how you want to phrase it, to LGBT issues in schools, to eminent domain, to healthcare, and the discussion around the bills has been really interesting. It's often been really heated, which I can understand. We are going to turn down that heat a little bit here, though, and give Tom and Carl a chance to speak their minds from their respective points on the political spectrum. The goal here really isn't debate, as I told both of them. It's trying to understand their points of view as clearly as possible. And I don't think you can actually have a really good debate until you understand what your opponent is arguing anyway. With that in mind, my questions are mainly intended to clarify what they believe, and I try not to put my thumb on the scale. I do have my own point of view, and I try to be honest about that when it comes up. Anyway, here we go. We'll start with Tom. We had a couple of technical issues when we started off the interview, so I don't give him a proper introduction. That was sort of cut, but here's Tom Hansen. Okay, so legislative session, there's a lot going on. Conservatives have large majorities in both the state house and Senate and the governor's office. And to me, it looks like they're fairly seamlessly or fairly easily moving along a bunch of conservative priorities. And I wonder how it looks to you.
I would disagree with you. One of the big problems we have right now, I'm co-chair of the Republican State Platform Committee. And we spend a lot of time gathering the thoughts of what the grassroots wants to see done down in Des Moines. You know, we start that, like the Democrats do, at caucus to make a state platform. And one of the big problems that we have this session is the Republicans not following the platform. There are things that they are doing that the people wanted, but there's a lot of other things, important issues that have been shoved in a desk drawer someplace and aren't seeing the light of day. But they have done some good things.
Can you elaborate a little bit on, let's talk about both of those things. Let's talk about the good things that you see, maybe if you want to point to a couple bills in particular, and then we can get to the stuff that you wish they would do.
Okay. One of the good things that the legislature did as far as passing a bill is the educational savings accounts. That's been on the minds and in our platform for a long time. And we have always saw it as giving parents a choice in education, because for many decades, people like me, conservatives, we see there being really two groups that are trying to gain control of America, and they're not Republican and Democrat. They're the people that believe government is our servant and people that believe government is our master. And people that believe government is a master have to keep a populace ignorant because it's a way to keep them dependent and in fear and incite division. And that's the way they get their agenda across. And like I said, that spans across the aisle. And people like me that believe that government is our servant know that one of the big keys to promoting success and ensuring liberty is education. And so when we see the educational system failing for so many years, the best way to remedy that is give people a choice to move someplace else. And so that's why we've been pushing so hard for educational savings accounts, in order to give people who are in failing school districts the opportunity to break that cycle and get their children the education that they need in order to achieve success and to further the goals of liberty.
Can I ask you to, so just to summarize kind of what you're saying, it sounds like you see public schooling as a place where government is overreaching on the freedoms of individual people. So you see that as, would you say that as far as like public schools as a whole go, or is it just specific public schools that are the issue?
Well, if I can, I've been in charge of putting on the community Thanksgiving dinner for 21 years. And every year I'm amazed that I get people from every group across society that come and help and not only make dinner, but sit down with others and eat from people all across society. So I've always looked at people, and I believe most conservatives do, that everyone is good-hearted. And I know there was a video out a couple years ago that went viral. You've probably seen it. It's got two little toddlers, one black, one white. They see each other at either end of the sidewalk. They don't know each other, but they just run together and they hug each other. That's what kids know. That kids aren't born with hatred. They have to learn that. And instead of schools teaching that people are good and we can get along, in order to further the agenda of government being our master, they have to create this division. And that's why, you know, in public schools, they teach the idea of division. You know, if you're black, you're oppressed, you're a victim. If you're white, you're the oppressor, you're the bad guy. And that went on for decades. And what happened was when we had COVID, the teachers union made the very idiotic move of saying, okay, we got to teach all the kids from school. We're going to do it all by computers. And what that did was it gave parents an opportunity to see exactly what was going on in school. And parents said, hey, wait a minute, we didn't know this was going on. And that's why you see all these bills now to try to change all that. Because parents have rightly thought that they have lost control of authority over their children. And they hadn't. The government was teaching them whatever they wanted to promote their agenda. And like I said, the agenda is that government, you need government in order to achieve in life and have a healthy life and do well and be successful. And that's not what most Americans believe. And that's...
Sorry to interrupt you there, but I just wanted to point to one thing you said specifically. It sounds like particular issues around, like, for example, questions of race that you see as teachers or administrators or schools as promoting more kind of a particular line on that most conservatives don't agree with. Is that kind of the gist of it?
Yeah, there's no doubt that, you know, this country, like any other country or world, has made mistakes throughout history. And, you know, children need to know that. But they also need to know that we have moved beyond that, that we've been steadily correcting those mistakes and moving more and more towards equality of our society. In some cases, more than any other countries in the world. Over in the Middle East, they're still throwing gay people off roofs. So we've steadily advanced our society, and that never gets any coverage. We're always going back to what was and how bad things were, and we never bring up how we've had advanced from there and where we are heading. So,
okay, yeah, I think that's pretty clear. So the voucher bill that was passed earlier this year, that was a big one, and let's get to some other ones that. Did you want to highlight anything else that you thought was particularly important? Was it that kind of the main one that you wanted to talk about?
The other thing that I thought was important was just what the governor did by executive order. She's, you know, one of a conservative views for a smaller government, smaller, more efficient government. It costs the people less. You have to tax people less. And what she did is, you know, there was 32 departments in the Iowa governor's in the Iowa government, and she's consolidating that down to 17. And she's also making every department go through their book of codes and rules and regulations and justifying every administrative law that's in there. And if they can't justify it, it's going to be gotten rid of, because that's one of the things that drives up costs, even with the schools with the school districts. If you look at the rise in population of children, and this is from the Department of Education, from 2000 to 2019, and that's the last year's statistics that they've published, the student population has rose 8%, the teacher population has rose 9%, and the administrative population has rose 88%. And the governor rightly says that, you know, well, maybe part of that reason is we just have too many administrative rules. So that's her way of saying, well, we're going to clean this up, and maybe the schools can clean that up, and we can cut down, because in any business, administrative costs are always there, especially nowadays, is one of your highest costs in any business. And if we can cut down on that, then we can use more money for the teachers and the teacher's salary.
That is an interesting bill, and I will admit I don't know.
Well, that was done by executive order.
Well, but she's also got the reorganization bill moving through, right?
I'm not sure if that was a bill.
Maybe it's both. It could be both, because I think Senate File 514, as I say, this particular bill is complicated, and it's interesting, though. And one thing interesting thing about it is that I think the idea of, you know, combining agencies, et cetera, trimming administrative bloat, that kind of thing. I mean, if it is that, I mean, it seems like you could get some Democrats on board with that one, too. Okay. Now, what would you have liked to have seen them brought to the table if they didn't?
Number one, first and foremost, was Senate File 91. What Senate File 91 did, if you remember back when all this COVID stuff started, the governor declared an emergency. They gave her emergency powers, and it gave her the authority to do basically whatever she wanted to do for as long as she wanted to do it. And no person, I don't care what party they are from, has the need to have that much power, and they shouldn't have that much power. And so what Senate File 91 did was to put a curb on the amount of power that the governor has, how long they can have it. The bill stated that they could the governor to declare emergency for only 60 days. And after 60 days, she had to go back to the legislature and ask for an extension, and the legislature could only extend it for another 60 days. So that was a very good bill that everybody I know on the Republican side, that was a priority, one of the legislative priorities in our state platform. Everybody wanted that. And I believe there were Democrats that wanted that too. Just like I said, for anyone to have that much power until they decide they want to give it up is not America. And it passed out of subcommittee, and it went into Senator Jason Schultz's desk drawer, and that's where it has sat. It never got assigned to a committee, and now that the first funnel date has passed and it hasn't passed out of a committee, that bill is technically, you know, dead for the year. So,
and that is in, but that priority is in the state Republican platform, you're saying?
Yes. Yes, and it's supported by all four districts in a Republican platform. The other one that's supported by all four districts, and I think probably just about every Democrat down there too, is the eminent domain bill.
It's one I've got on my list here.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, that's one of our basic tenets of American liberty, is to be sovereign over your property. And it's one thing, and rightly so, that the government can come in for public use, roadways, airports, and stuff like that, and take property for public use. But, you know, we had the back in 2005, we had the Kelo versus the City of New London decision by the Supreme Court that said the government could take it also for public benefit, which meant that private companies could use the government to take public property in order for them to make a profit. And that's just completely unconstitutional. It's un-American. And that's why you, with that bill, you had across the board support for it. And once again, our Republican elected officials caved, didn't follow the platform. And I'm not quite sure
on the current status.
On the status of that bill currently.
I think the Senate one died. When I saw that, I kind of assumed it was dead. But apparently it's still alive in the House. So
the House passed a bill, and it went to the Senate, and then the Senate just kind of has not done anything with it.
People seem, somewhat pessimistic that it is going to pass this session. And you're right, it has been interesting to watch how that one breaks down as far as parties go. And it seems, am I right in thinking, geared toward especially the three carbon pipelines that are currently somewhat in development in the state, and would restrict their, you might not be able to get them built with if you had this bill passed, because it sounds like it reduces the threshold at which you can use eminent domain as a private company. You need a greater proportion of, you need like
90%.
Yeah. So what's your take on the, if I might ask, just on the carbon pipelines generally?
The carbon pipelines would not even exist if the government hadn't put a tax or a bounty on sequestering carbon. When they did that, that opened up that door. And that's why the reason these pipelines exist. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here at all. And being a conservative and a free market person, I'm all for businesses trying out whatever they want to do. But don't be asking the taxpayer, not only for money, but asking the government to take private property so that you can do the project.
Do you have, one thing I was curious about is, do you have corn grower friends, acquaintances, whatever, who come to you and say, no, we need these pipelines because we need ethanol?
I just got in a discussion.
What are those conversations like?
What I always tell them is that if this was something that the government was trying to force down on you, you'd have a completely different take. I talked to one corn grower over in Cresco. Farm Bureau had a meeting over there. And he was a big corn grower, and he owned stock in an ethanol plant. He owns part of a ethanol gas station over there. And he just, thought this was great. And, I said to him, I said, well, if the government came to you and said, hey, you got to get rid of your diesel tractor, you have to use an electric tractor, I said, you would be the first one crying that the government is overstepping their bounds. Well, that'll never happen. I said, well, I'm just using that as an example. And I said, it's true. I said, but because it's putting a dollar in your pocket, you're all for the government doing this. And I said, how far do you want to go down this road? What's the next industry that comes along and with an idea that they can't get done without using the government to take personal private property? And it's just a very slippery slope to get down, to go down. And that's the general view of, the people that that own stock in the ethanol plants and gas stations. That there was a Farm Bureau member there that he had a gas pipeline going through his property. And he says, I have no problem with that because they came to me and they asked me. And he says, I get a dividend check from them every year. And he says, so I have no problem with that. He says, but with the ethanol companies, they want to come in, they want to give me a one-time check and then walk away. And he says, there's been no studies done on, what happens if the CO2 pipelines break, how much damage is done. He says, we don't know the risk. And he says, they're going about this very haphazardly. And so it was nice to see, Farm Bureau members on either side of this.
It's an interesting issue. I mean, it really cuts across political boundaries in a way that you don't see many things do. Because, a lot of environmentalists also oppose the carbon pipelines for different reasons. Some of them like the carbon capture thing and want to do it. It's an interesting one. All right, let's get to a couple other things here. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I did want to talk about a couple of bills in particular. So we haven't mentioned the education stuff in particular, the LGBT issues in education. And there's a bunch of bills, as you probably know, bathroom bills. There's a bill that prohibits instruction about gender identity through the sixth grade. And then there's the gender affirming. This is outside of education, but there's no there's a ban on gender affirming health care for Iowans under 18. So basically, you could put it in kind of the buckets of gender and sexuality stuff related to education, but also to minors, kind of the two components of that. And to me, it seems like part of this has to be, a lot of people have been wondering why so many, you know, so fast in this session, bills on that kind of topic. And part of it, I would imagine, has to be due to a response to like the gay rights and trans rights movements, what they're doing. Do you see it that way, or do you think these are priorities that are conservatives would be doing anyway? What's your take on these?
First of all, I wonder sometimes, and no one's really been able to explain to me, you know, what rights do gays not have? I'm very opposed to creating special groups and giving them special rights in the names of trying to achieve equality. That's not how you achieve equality. You achieve equality by making the law apply to everyone in the same way. I've gay friends, I have lesbian friends, what rights are you not getting specifically because you're part of the LGBT community? And I've never got a clear answer on that. And the other part of it goes back to what I was saying before, is that all this was being done prior without any consent of the parents. Parents didn't know what was going on. And a lot of these bills I just see as pro-parent bills, giving the parents authority over their children again as to what they can learn in school, where it rightly belongs. And so I don't see it as any kind of anti-gay or anti-LGBT community bills. They're just returning. I see a lot of them as pro-parent bills and protecting the children. We always have, one of the discussions that always comes up is people with penises going into a girl's bathroom. Most people think that's not right. But that was part of the agenda that was being pushed in schools without parents knowing about it. And this is just a way for the parents to say, these are my kids. I have authority over them. They're not your kids. And I want to say so over what's being learned here.
And you think that the, just to kind of return to the number of them this session, you don't see this necessarily as a response to like LGBT rights movements agitating for more accommodations in school for teenagers who might be trans, more just like a broader public sort of awareness of this stuff happening? Do you think the number of these bills is, I guess the question I'm trying to get at, is tied to that?
Well, I'd have to disagree with you. I think they are pushing for more and more stuff in the schools. We just had the bill that was passed a couple years ago about boys playing in girls' sports. A lot of people, in the LGBT community thought there was nothing wrong with that. There's a lot of people, especially women athletes, who had a problem with that, who had to compete against boys. So I think they are constantly trying to push their agenda. And yeah, this is probably a pushback to saying, no, we're going to try to find some equilibrium here. And like I said, we're going to give parents back the authority over their children.
And the cultural issues, all these cultural issues as far as, the stuff we just talked about, school stuff, what else is there? I guess there's the question of race. That's another one. Those are places where you see the government being kind of, or people who are pro-government control, I guess, in your language, are most active, it sounds like, to you.
Well, and again, as I stated, that in order to have control over society, you have to have society divided. If society is united in saying, we don't really care what our neighbor does, leave us alone, those people that believe government is our master lose power. They have no more power over society. So they got to keep up with this agitation all the time in order to push their agenda. And like I said, that group that believes government is our master, it goes on both sides of the aisle.
Thank you for that. Let's see what else I have here. We talked about the eminent domain stuff. We talked about school vouchers.
Educational savings accounts.
Oh, yes. That's interesting. Terminological difference. Well, we're going to get to another one here because you could call HSB House Study Bill 134 either a bill about youth employment or you could call it a child labor bill. And there might be a political inflection to whichever term you chose there.
Well, I noticed just reading over that, a lot of that was just changing the wording from occupation to working, what's the term today? I should have wrote it down. They were just taking out the word occupation. And from what I read of the bill, Is that Senate File 356?
I can never keep it straight. They changed the numbers.
No, I've got Senate File 167.
167 is what I've got for the Senate file, yeah.
And a lot of what I read in that bill, it seemed like the point of that bill, we're pushing a lot more now for vocational education and work studies. And from what I read of the bill, a lot of that was geared towards the 14 to 17 years old, having more freedom to do certain work studies. It even changed like the driving restrictions on licenses so that they could get back and forth to work studies. And so that was kind of the gist that I seen of the bill. I don't know what your opinion is on it. But
I read that was one that I did read through. And of course, they are complicated because they're revising things from the past,
yes.
Striking things out, and you can't figure. But what it looked like to me was they were lowering the age. And I saw 15, and I've seen now the number 14 floated around.
Yep.
At which they were. Previously, they have the special category of basically like industrial work. And so that's things like mining, slaughterhouses, factories.
Right.
That was 16 and up. And they lowered that down to, I thought 15.
No, but the mining, slaughterhouses, they're still prohibited under this bill.
You sure from what
I, yes, I okay. am positive. Because that was one of the things that that they weren't allowing. It's more vocational educations that they were allowing, industrial arts, stuff like that. There's still a lot that's being restricted by this bill.
Well, we'll have to see on that one. And these things change so quickly too. People are pulling stuff out,
change every
stuff
day.
Back in. Yeah. The last one I have is, I have two more. Healthcare. Do you have anything to say about the, governor's omnibus healthcare bill? It's got some stuff around pregnancy crisis centers in there, which provide pregnancy-related services, but also encourage alternatives to abortion. It's got $2 million for those. It's got
what bill are we talking about? Because I have these written down by number.
Yeah, that's so. The governor's omnibus healthcare bill, I think, is House File 427 and Senate File 324.
I've got one Senate File 496.
Well, again, these numbers change, but that one is like it's that stuff, and then it's it funds OBGYN training fellowships to address maternal healthcare shortages.
That's the one I have listed as Senate File 496. So, like you said, it's probably gotten six different numbers now. What I see now, reading through that, part of the pro-abortion movement, part of the criticism they had of the pro-life movement was that, you want us to have these babies, but then you just want to walk away and not do anything. And what Senate File 496 does, it does a lot to help out parents, right? It's up to 2 years after they have a child. It has a fatherhood work training program to try to bring families back together. It helps with the licensing of OBG, OBGYN. And so what I read from this bill is that we were criticized for not doing anything after the baby's born. And what this bill does is say, okay, here we are. We're going to do this. We're going to help you take care of the kids. We're going to help the fathers reunite with the families, try to hold the family unit together, help people find work. So I thought it was very another, if you want to call it a pro-life bill or pro-family bill, we were criticized for saying, yeah, have a kid and then leave it. And now we're actually doing something. The governor is doing something to try to help out with that situation. So I think that's a good bill.
And this is not at all, this is not intended to be any kind of gotcha question here, but I'm genuinely curious. You limited government, right? Government spending, we got to have an eagle eye on that and government mm-hmm. intervention in our lives and in.
Yep.
So what makes this kind of stuff, because this is a layout of cash for families, what makes this different?
Yep. And I, you know, that's what I've discussed with people too. You know, how much of this are we going to do? But in order to change society, you got to at some point say, we got to do something different here. Whether this is something permanent, I don't know. But if you are going to change society, yeah, there's a point. Things have gotten to the point where they are now that you have to say, you know, okay, it might take some money here to change things and make society better. So instead of letting it go down the same road, you know, let's give it another avenue to go down and see where it goes. I don't want this to see this become something, you know, that goes on for the next 100 years. But if we can change the directions of keeping families together, allowing, you know, more people to have their baby and be able to take care of it and making society better, then I think that's worth the investment by the government.
Okay, that's where we're going to have to leave it for now. There's more that Tom and I talked about that wouldn't fit on this episode, including issues about local budgets and property tax reform, which we may fold into a later episode along with the same stuff from Carl's interview, which is what we're turning to now. So without any further ado, here's my interview with Carl Hockenstead. Okay, so with me here is Carl Hockenstead, the chair of Winneshiek County Democrats. He has come on to talk about the state legislature and what's happened so far in this session. Here we are about a week after the first legislative funnel. So he's going to talk about, well, really talk in his capacity as chair of the Dems and talk about a few bills that are of particular note for them. And then we're going to go through some other ones, actually the very same ones that I talked about with earlier last week with Tom Hansen, the Republican chair.
Thanks, Nate, for having me. I guess when you asked about the bills that you thought of as the most important, one of the ones that jumped to my mind first was the school choice bill, also known as the vouchers for private school bill, depending on how you want to frame it. Because to me, I think that really struck a chord with so many people, and not only in the way that it was passed, I think they only debated it for less than 24 hours, and it was a bill that is going to change one of the important functions of state government or government in general is K-12 education, and I thought it was a really big change to the education system. And public schools are so important to, especially a lot of these rural, small town communities. Your public school is really the hub of your town, for not only educating the kids, but then, holding public meetings. You know, it can be some of the last public spaces in these small communities. And I really do worry that the effect that it will have on these public communities. Especially if it does, if indeed as it is predicted to to lose students, you know, if they take their dollars with them to private schools, I think that really could be detrimental to public schools that are maybe already kind of on the edge as far as enrollment. And I mean, we're already losing people in a lot of these small communities. So if 12 people leave and they're already on the edge, that could be the difference between staying open and being closed. And so I thought that kind of ties into a theme of some of the priorities I've seen at the legislature this year, that it feels like the Republicans have really pushed hard on bills that are almost more philosophy over practicality, you know, that's driven more by their ideology than it is actually trying to solve a concrete problem.
So you mentioned that the biggest worry is students in schools that are already kind of on the edge enrollment-wise, sort of declining, losing enough students that it forces them to close. I've also heard from Democrats some dissatisfaction with the fact that not all rural areas have access to private schools. Is there a more, because those seem kind of like two sort of different points to make. Is it both of those points that you think are important?
I do. I mean, I guess I personally view them as two sides of the same coin, but I see what you're saying, that it is on a practical point that yes, in a lot of, you know, rural Iowa, there might not be private schools available. So I guess you're right that they might not siphon away as many students there. But I mean, that does raise another point that, you know, this bill, you know, if it is about choice, I mean, it really could probably benefit students more in Des Moines, in Iowa City, in Cedar Rapids, places with a lot more private school choices, you know. So it does feel like the benefits will be going probably to students in these, in the more urban areas, to be honest. And yeah, so.
Here's another question I have, and this is not to put you on the spot. I'm just curious to see, I haven't heard that many people talking about this argument, but it's one of the more, I don't know, interesting arguments I've heard from Republicans about why the voucher bill might not be so bad for public schools. So I think Mike Klimisch was talking at one point about in his district, which includes us, right? Yeah, Winship, yep. County. There are something, I think he maybe threw out the number, like currently like 700 ish private school students, and for each one, don't quote me on that exact number, but there's a fair amount of existing private school students. We have some private schools here. For each one of those, he pointed out there's this backfill amount of like $1,200 that goes to public schools.
Yes.
Which public schools, so they'll get that for students who leave, right, and go, mm-hmm, to private schools, but it hadn't dawned on me that, oh yeah, they're probably going to also get that for students who are already in private schools.
Right.
And so he's arguing that this is actually a windfall for public schools. He said in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for his district because of those private school students who are already not in public schools, and money will be coming for each one of them to public schools.
Yeah.
Do you buy that line of thinking? Is that,
to be honest, I don't. I had went to his legislative forum at NICC with he and Representative Bergen, and they did discuss that, and I was a little unclear how that mechanism works, so I might not be the most well-versed to speak on that. But I mean, so if a student, you know, yes, yeah, so the existing private school students, you know, the kids, like, let's say, go to Catholic School Elementary, because I think those are some of the only private schools that exist in our district. So yeah, so if it is 700, so then the school will get $1,200 per student.
The district, the public school district, will,
yes,
get $1,200.
And that is great. I mean, more funding for public schools is what I and a lot of Democrats have always wanted, you know. So I think that, you know, any extra funding to go to public schools is a good thing. I wish we could have sent more of that funding to public schools without also supporting these vouchers, because I just, you know, on a practical and philosophical level, just don't think that is right. And yeah, so then also, I guess you do have to look at the fact that, I mean, I don't remember what the exact level is of money that, you know, the district gets per pupil, that if those students leave the district, they get $1,200, $1,205, but then that student leaves, I think that would still be a negative 6,400 sums for those students.
Right.
So I guess I don't know exactly how, you know, it would all come out in the wash with some students, you know, maybe leaving eventually. But yeah, so maybe it would be additional funding this year, but is that going to continue into the future? That is another question, I guess. I don't know.
Fair question. It does seem like it really depends on how many students leave. Like that's the question that I think is on probably a lot of district officials' minds. And in a place like Winneshiek County, where we have, well, even in Decorah alone, we have three private schools that could, you know, see new students coming in with vouchers. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, you know, what the impact would be on the district. I don't know. I want to talk to district officials to see how concerned they are about this. I know that in general, you know, superintendents across the state seemed like broadly opposed to it. Yeah. But as I say, there is this argument out there that, well, there is going to be this new influx of cash from the backfill. And that's something that I personally want to know more about.
Yeah. And if I may jump in, then that is in some of these questions and kind of not really knowing how this will look in the long term is why I wish we could have had a longer debate. It felt like the bill had been brought up in the past, so it's not completely new, but it was a different version of the bill. So I wish that they would have allowed more time for public input, but it just felt like Reynolds proposed the bill and it got into the legislature and it just felt like it was really rushed through before there was time for a full debate to happen about the bill. So I really wish, and then they also rushed it through before getting the cost estimate from the Legislative Services Agency, which, I mean, if you're going to do something so big and, you know, such a big change and also, you know, involving this much money, I really wish we could have waited to hear those cost estimates before passing it and or having more time for public debate and input. So,
yeah. Okay. That's one. Do you have another one that you wanted to jump to, or should we go right to my list?
Let's go to the list. Honestly.
Okay. Yeah. All right, cool. So the first one I have is just a category of that I've labeled LGBT issues in education, because a lot of those bills relate to education as well. So I mentioned Senate File 496 in the thing I sent you. So that's the omnibus bill, the governor's education bill, which includes provision that makes it mandatory for schools to notify parents if their child adopts a new gender identity. It limits instruction on some subjects in the early grade levels. And then it's got the provision about pulling a book from shelves in one school district, or if it's been challenged successfully by parents. So there's a new mechanism for parents to challenge titles. I think that's new. I need to double check that. But in any case, if a title in a library or in a curriculum is challenged successfully in one district, it's then put on a list for all of the districts, and then it sounds like you need parental approval in order to check out that book if it's in a library, if it's been successfully challenged. So there's that stuff. We've also got, there's a bathroom bill banning students from using a bathroom that is not the one of their sex assigned at birth, including locker room facilities. And then this is not quite education, but then there's the ban on gender affirming healthcare, puberty blockers under the age of 18. So there's a bunch of these bills dealing with LGBT issues, and many of them in education. I know that this has been a subject that has been really at the forefront of a lot of liberals' minds in the state, especially due to the number of the bills, I think. So I'll just kind of give you the floor on those. You can tell me what you think, what people you've talked to are thinking about these bills.
I guess I would maybe start with, I do feel like we should be reminded in these conversations that the people who these bills affect are vulnerable, you know, kids sometimes, you know, or teenagers, you know, and I do think that this is a population that already feels very marginalized and bullied at times and can have higher suicide rates. So I do think we need to remind ourselves that this is the population we're talking about. and that I do feel like these bills feel, I don't know, mean-spirited might be too far, but it does feel like it's putting pressure on these already vulnerable teenagers. Is, you know, just they are young people who are already kind of vulnerable, and so I do feel like we just need to be reminded that even if, you know, because I do feel like so much of the conversation and the knowledge of gender identity, as you know, all so much of that stuff has changed so much, that I do feel like, you know, and myself included, we are all still trying to understand what it means to people and what it means to be transgender. And so I do feel like it's kind of just an overall philosophical level. I feel like it's frustrating for the legislature to put so much of a focus on this. And it feels like they are coming at it from this very top-down place where they feel like they are protecting, they are trying to say they're protecting the kids, but I don't really feel like that is the spirit of the bills or what the bills will actually do in the end.
You feel like it's punitive, would you say?
Or just kind of grandstanding, where it's like, this legislative session has had such a big focus on this. When it's like, you know, the bathroom bills, I mean, how much of an important issue is this really? But there's so much focus on it. I mean, it's incredibly important to the people who might identify as transgender, and it feels incredibly important to them if they are told that, like, how they are feeling, that they, what gender they identify as is wrong. But to most people in their daily lives, what is the importance of where somebody goes to the bathroom?
So if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like you're concerned philosophically about the content of the bills, for sure. It sounds like, but it also sounds like you see some of this stuff that's happening as almost like a, I don't know if theatrical is too strong of a word, but like symbolic, like,
yes, a very symbolic fight when we, you know, if you look at what really, you know, is affecting people's lives most of the time, it's, you know, good jobs and access to healthcare and, you know, enough money to pay the bills and buy your groceries and, you know, clean water, you know, is a huge problem in our state. And, you know, there are so many more important things that Iowa needs to focus on. And how many of these bills have we had where it's like trying to, police, you know, these hot button social issues. It just feels like we're focusing so much on that when there are so many other things that Iowa should be focusing on, when we're losing population in these rural areas and we're driving people away because we are, you know, being viewed as, and some of these bills can be viewed as discriminatory. But so in thinking about some of these specific bills, like, so there's the, I think it is Senate File 496, where it is the requiring a school to notify parents if a student changes gender identity. I might not have the exact bill, but it's in some bill that survived.
I believe it's in that one. Funnel. Yeah.
Okay. I was thinking about that today when I was at work, and I was like, of course you want, in an ideal world, any kid should be able to talk with their parent about anything they're facing. You know, that's great. Obviously, you want to be able to turn to your parents if you are feeling, you know, it's just something's going on in your life. But I guess, and a lot of kids hopefully can, you know, that would be great if kids feel comfortable no matter what the issue is, you know, if they're thinking that they might be transgender, or, you know, or if, you know, they're, you know, somebody offered them, you know, alcohol or something, whatever, teen issues, you know. But so you wish that people could be able to talk with their parents about anything. But realistically, I think what you need to think about is that some kids who might not feel that they are in a safe place to be able to talk to their parents. I assume that is what, if kids didn't feel like they could talk to their parents about such a central thing, I assume they are coming at it from the place of that they don't feel like they can, or their parents will just reject them, or, you know, challenge them, or tell them they're wrong. So I just feel like this kind of top down, like, these issues are hard, and I feel like they should be centered around, you know, the people who they affect and their families too. I mean, but I don't feel like the legislature should tell, you know, teens and their families how their social lives should be handled. You know, this, and kind of like the, you know, healthcare for trans kids under 18. I do feel like that's another one where it's like that decision should be made between the doctors, the, you know, the kids or the teens and their family. You know, I don't feel like the legislature should be in the place of just completely saying, no, this is going to be illegal in Iowa. I feel like that, I mean, there have been studies that show that that kind of care, you know, for some trans teenagers is really good for them and can really help them, you know, just feel more themselves and fit in more. But I have also, I read an article a while back talking about how we do have to take seriously that there are some people who maybe go through like hormone treatment or other treatments like that and do regret it later. I mean, that is reality. That does happen. But I do feel like, again, this should be a decision that is centered around the people that it affects and their family and their doctor.
Well, you just made an argument there about kind of government control, really, if you think about it, like, which is oftentimes a Republican sort of talking point. But it's interesting how these issues have kind of flipped the script there a little bit or gotten. And you saw some of that with, I don't know, some of the political boundaries around when is government doing too much, when is government reaching too far into our lives, have gotten a little murkier over the last few years. Like, yes. COVID was an interesting thing there, in that respect too. But it seems like that's one thing that I'm hearing from Democrats on these issues, is that this is, for them, a lot of the time, a question about the right to be free of government imposition.
Yeah. It is kind of an ironic cross current there, yeah.
But government is hugely influential in our lives, and you can imagine people from all political stripes having reasons to do things with the government and accomplish things, but also resist intervention from the government into your life.
Right.
Yeah.
And you could look at that also with you know, I mean, you can see this nationwide, the kind of focus on certain books in the library. And, you know, I mean, I think about it as academic freedom, and, you know,
right,
that you really can, you know, that I feel like people sometimes pull out small passages from a book and, you know, therefore view it as obscene or, you know, and without looking at the book in the larger context. I do think you just need to look at it through academic freedom, and, like, especially, you know, that these public, you know, our teachers are well trained in what is, you know, good reading material for challenging people sometimes,
right,
for, you know, for learning, for expanding your horizons, for thinking about things from a different perspective.
Right.
And I think sometimes I am very skeptical of some of these books that go after certain materials in libraries.
Well, again, yeah, that feels like another place where Democrats could make an argument about, you know, top-down government control and use the language of academic freedom to do that. On the other hand, I could hear the Republican response already, which would be that, well, these are state employees, so they actually are government employees, and really the group of people who is burdened with too much government intervention is the parents, right? Because you have the idea that state employees are forcing particular books on parents and sort of infringing on their right to have a say, or maybe even some conservatives might say control over what kinds of thinking or ideology or philosophy or whatever their kid encounters. So I'm not saying I agree with either one of those, but I think that would probably be the counter argument there.
But I guess I would just say also, then, when did we become so scared of ideas in books? You know, why do we need to shut ourselves off from ideas we might not like? And I'm sure you could make that argument to me. I don't, you know, read conservative books all the time, you know, but it's like, when did we become so scared in America, in Iowa, of ideas and exposure to them? Why is it necessary to completely, say that these ideas are out of bounds and we can't even discuss them? We can't even talk about them? Because some of these issues are just basic reality. You know, the existence of gay people, the existence of trans people. You know, some of these bills want to not be able to talk about that, and from kindergarten through third grade. And obviously it's a sensitive subject when you're talking about those issues with kids that young, but it's reality. There are gay people in this world. There are gay people in this town. You know, it's just, and so I feel like sometimes we try to, like, you know, hide these ideas when it's just, they are reality. You know, like racism in history, that is just reality. I mean, we could debate for hours about, you know, its current role in society and, you know, and or, but it's just the truth that it has existed throughout our country's history. So, you know, and I, so I feel like sometimes we try to go after these ideas that are just reality.
Yeah. And I happen to, I mean, I shared my point of view with Tom. I can do it with you too. I happen to agree that, you know, racism, and even you could say systemic racism, is a reality. That to me feels like the truth. Doesn't change the fact that we disagree about the truth. Like, that's one of the real right. the things in this country is, like, you know, there are conservative historians, probably very, very few historians, who would argue that there's no racism in the history of this country, or there was never,
there wouldn't be too many.
Never, you know, systemic legalized racism. Probably no one would argue that. But, you know, in terms of what the truth of this country's history with respect to an issue like race actually is, I mean, everybody thinks, seems to think, or both sides anyway, seem to think that they have a real strong claim on that truth. And
point taken. No, it's true. But I do feel like, I mean, I a lot of my friends are public school teachers. And when you think about trying to teach American history without bringing up, what do they call it, divisive concepts like racism, how do you teach American history without bringing up divisive concepts like racism? I honestly find, I read a lot of history, honestly, and I find it much more fascinating when you get the full picture, when you learn some of the dark, nitty-gritty episodes of our history. I mean, it's just, I don't know how you really can learn an honest, thorough history of America unless you discuss that, you know, and it's, we can debate what role it's had, you know, and or how important it is currently, but I just feel like it's wrong to say that we can't discuss some of these things in a school setting.
Okay, so let's move on. Healthcare. We've got healthcare left. We've got, I wanted to talk about youth employment, child labor, the eminent domain thing as well. So let's take your pick of those three. Which would you like to talk about first?
I looked at some of the healthcare bills, and honestly, I didn't feel super informed on them. What I read sounded like it was good progress, because I do feel like that is another thing that, you know, really is important to small towns and rural areas. Is, you know, I experienced this with my wife recently, where we had to, you know, you can be seen by the clinic here, but then so often you have to drive to Rochester or La Crosse for more specialized care. And so I do think, you know, it sounds like the legislature passed some bills trying to, you know, invest in clinics in, you know, smaller towns, rural areas. So I will give Republicans some plaudits for that. Well done. It sounds like they, you know, made an investment in that. So it sounded like good overall.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it does seem like there's some bipartisan,
yeah,
good feeling about some of that stuff. I'm sure there are Democrats who would feel, you know, a lot of it doesn't go far enough, of course. But
yes, But hey, sometimes you gotta just celebrate something good that was done,
right?
You know? And especially if it's bipartisan, that doesn't happen that much anymore. So.
Right. You can't just go straight negative,
exactly,
because it's not enough.
Try to be positive.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. All right. Anything to say? I mean, eminent domain, that's a fun one.
That is. And luckily, that is actually,
I don't necessarily mean it's eminent domain itself is fun, but I mean the debate around it, the discussion is interesting.
And that is another one that actually has seen some bipartisan agreement, bipartisan push. I think the bill that is still alive, you correct me if I'm wrong, is that one of the big things is that you can't use eminent domain unless 90% of the other like properties have already given voluntary easements, I believe. Yeah. And I think that I know eminent domain is necessary at times, but I do think this bill seems like a good step in protecting people's property rights. And you know,
are you a yes carbon capture or no carbon capture guy, or do you not have a strong you don't have to have a strong opinion on that?
I mean so a carbon capture from ethanol specifically,
well that I mean yeah you could I mean, go that direction yeah
I mean I believe in the I believe I listen to I what is it like 98% of scientists who tell us that climate change is a real and, you know, and present danger. It is currently happening, you know, I mean, so I do think we need to look at any and all technologies to try to capture more carbon, you know, drive us more towards renewable energy. So I think carbon capture in general is a good idea. The ethanol pipelines, I'm a little more skeptical of the carbon capture from the ethanol plants involving these pipelines. I'm a little more skeptical of on just a straight up carbon climate level, but I'm very much think we need to, you know, address climate change in all its ramifications, which are many.
Okay, we're going to leave it there for this episode. I also discussed a couple of other bills with Tom and Carl, including Senate File 356, which revamps the way local governments collect property taxes. We also discussed local government more generally, including the recent budget decisions at the county level around the Conservation Board and the Roadside Management Program. And that stuff wouldn't fit here, but I may release that as a bonus episode at some point. Also, FYI, there are a bunch of bills we didn't get to, including really important ones that emerged after we talked, like the bill limiting the powers of the state auditor, which has made a bunch of news recently. Okay, that's it. See you next time.